Hello, my friends. This is The Thing About Cars, coming to you from all around the city of Atlanta, I think. At least I think we're all around Atlanta today. We have a full table again. Around the table, we have Dawn.
I'm here.
And Ben.
Hey there.
And Becca.
Hi.
And Jessica.
Hello.
There's Jessica. And a guest for this today, this episode, Bill. Bill, you're there.
I'm here.
Thanks for joining us, Bill.
Before
we get into our typical who knows bric-a-brac topic stuff, I think we should do a grand trivia auto question. So our grand trivia auto question for this episode is one of the most infamous failures in automotive history. This Ford Marquis lasted just three model years from 1958 to 1960 and lost hundreds of millions of dollars. It did not make any money whatsoever. So was that Marquis the Corvair, the Pinto, the Nova, or the Edsel? Bill, what are you driving? How do you know Ben? I understand you have a connection to the group Unloved Autos on Facebook.
I've been part of Unloved Autos since I got thrown out of the predecessor group for posting pictures of hearses, which the moderator didn't like, and I didn't like the moderator. So every once in a while, I'd post a flower car or a hearse, and finally he had enough of me. That was my passive-aggressive introduction to Unloved Autos.
So I have to ask, you got thrown out for posting pictures of hearses?
Yes. The moderator of the previous group was, let's be nice and say, a little tightly wound.
Okay.
He did not want pictures of hearses or flower cars posted in the group. So every once in a while, I just couldn't resist.
What was his problem with hearses?
I don't know. But all I know is that I haven't seen or heard from him in years because I've been unfriended and blocked.
Well,
oh my goodness. Tightly wound is being nice, it sounds like.
Seems to me if that's the thing that ruins your day, then you have bigger problems than the rest of us. So
that was my thought too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, this raises several things that I wanted to talk about, but I saw this ad for an old 50s era hearse that had a 500 cubic engine in it. And ever since then, I've sort of wanted one.
Well, I did too. When I was in high school, another fellow had a 1960 Cadillac hearse with big pointy fins on the back. And I wanted that car. And my mother and father said, absolutely not. And it would have been a good strategy for me to get almost any other kind of car that I wanted if I had been thinking that way, just to have dropped that out there as a balloon. But mm-hmm. I wanted the hearse. And one day my friend backed out of my driveway and there was a Chevy van across the street. And he wasn't quite looking what he was doing, and he poked one of the fins right through the side of the van.
Oh,
nice.
It punctured it very neatly, like almost like a surgical scalpel. And after that, I decided maybe I didn't need a car that was quite that big.
Right. Oh, my goodness. Well, so our standard question for our guest, I think, has become what's currently in your garage, and what would you like to be in your garage?
Well, I have everything I want. I'm a very lucky boy. I have three old cars that I've collected over the years and I've restored from the ground up in my garage. I have a 1966 Mustang that I've had since I was 18 years old.
Hi, Bill. Can I come over to your house?
Yeah. I have a 1957 Thunderbird in willow green, which is a rare color.
No. Wait, now I have to bring my mom with me.
Well, girls like this color. It's a girl color car. It's unusual in that willow green was a 1958 color, and they made two-seat 1957 Thunderbirds through the end of calendar year 57, when they usually cut off production in August to start to make the new models. But they made, I don't know what the number is, close to 600 additional 57 Thunderbirds, two-seat, at the same time they were making the new four-seat one. And one of the only running changes was that they started using the 1958 colors. So I didn't realize when I got it that willow green Thunderbirds are unusual and, to some people, I suppose, desirable. So I don't dare change it. And the third car I have is a...
Before you go to number three, I'm wondering, willow green, I'm not familiar with that name. I'm wondering if that is the one that my mom calls turquoise.
It isn't turquoise, but if turquoise was green, it would be turquoise green. It's like mint green, the same color as kitchens were in 1958.
I think that's the one that she does like. I really do need to bring my mom over there.
I'm looking at it online. It's real. That's a pretty color. Yeah, very minty looking for sure.
I didn't mean to cut you off. So no, proceed to your third car. I just had to question about the color.
The third car I have is the car that I wanted ever since one roared past me when I was on my bike when I was about 9 years old. And I went home and announced to my dad we absolutely had to buy a supercharged Studebaker Avanti.
And you have a Studebaker.
I do. He told me we were not going to buy a used Studebaker. The Studebaker was going out of business. And he finished the conversation by saying, if I wanted a Studebaker, I could save my money when I grew up and buy one. So I guess I did.
Wow.
Well done. Well done, Bill. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm single now. I'm going to come over to your house.
Well, if I add another car, I'll be single too. So,
so Bill. Oh,
then he needs one of my shirts that says, I promise just one more car.
Bill, what is your daily driver? I'm assuming these three are not your daily drivers.
I have a red current model BMW that I drive every day.
Okay. Very cool. All right. So I forgot where I was going to go with this. There was a segue I had in mind, and this is it. I slipped another gear. Jessica brought up something earlier in the interstitials time when she sort of commented out loud that the phrase reputable dealer may mean something different to her than it does to us. And I thought that would be a useful thing to visit again, because I think we may all end up being on the same page. But then again, she may be right. The those of us that are car people may not look at dealerships the same way as those who are admittedly not car people. How would you explain that difference, Jessica?
Well, like I said earlier, I think that the big dealerships feel really predatory as far as the sales go. But when I say reputable dealer, you guys asked me what that meant, and my only response was that it was the only one that didn't have like 1-star reviews and basically sell lemons. But small dealerships where I am seem to mostly have like inconsistent opening times, no availability to test drive the cars, no way to get in touch with the mechanic. They seem really unsafe where, mm-hmm. In the town I grew up in, the local dealership was the place to go, and everyone who got a car there was happy. And if there were any issues, you could go back and be like, hey, what's this? And they'd fix it. So I just, like, as far as reputable dealership, I went with Toyota because I know that I could go back there and be like, hey, what's this? And even if I'd have to pay to fix something, I could depend on the mechanics there to theoretically fix it, where I know from hearing people at a dealership laugh about it that one of the small car dealerships next to me does fix things in the engine with duct tape. So,
goodness.
Oh, in their defense, I have fixed things with duct tape.
But were you selling the car to somebody?
No.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure you weren't charging $80 an hour for your time on that repair.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would love to be able to charge $80 an hour for my repairs.
Right.
You know, I also think that people look at reputation based on what they're expecting. For me, when I go, if and when I go to a dealership, I want to talk cars. I want to talk, you know, what's the features? What's the performance? I'm going to go there armed with a lot of details about.
Right.
And so if they poo-poo it and say, oh, you know, look down at me, I walk away. I have a really funny story. When my husband and I were first married, we were trying to replace the probe, and we had gone from dealership to dealership and were toying with foreign other than European cars. And everywhere I went, there was the same sales guy from Jonesboro to Morrow to Noonan to Peachtree City over a month. And I said, that's ridiculous. Ridiculous.
The same person, Don? Like literally the same person?
Literally. It was the weirdest thing. It was before, you know, we're talking about the mid-90s. It was the most strange thing. And he treated me like I knew nothing about cars. So I was like, by the third time, I was like, I cannot believe this. I just like literally turned around and got back in my probe and drove away.
Wow.
Yeah. It was the most bizarre thing in the world.
Well, I, you know, thinking about Jessica's phrase "reputable dealer," there's a part of me that wants to take issue with the phrase first of all and say that let's take out the word dealer and put in the word car sales entity, right? Because a dealer to me is like a corporate branded event where, you know, the Honda name, it's an actual Honda dealership, or it's a Toyota dealership, or whatever, versus someplace else I may go to buy a car, which could just be a sales lot that's not associated specifically with the brand. Is that not what you're getting at, Jessica? Or are you simply talking about like brand specific kinds of sales entities?
Oh no, that is what I'm talking about. Like where you can buy a car.
Okay.
Again, not a car person, use general terms probably the way they're not supposed to be used.
Right. No. And it's fine. I just wanted to make sure that we were talking about car sales in general and not just dealers.
Yep.
Yeah. Got it.
Yeah. And you know, my uncles were both mechanics and sales guys when I was growing up, and had their own place, and we just hung out at the car place, the dealership. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they were branded with a national company like Ford, Chrysler. Sometimes they were, you know, doing more mechanical work and just happened to be selling some cars.
Right.
Yeah, the dealership in LJ was called Twin City Motors, and they're really great, but they didn't have like a nationwide brand attached to them because they just dealt in all kinds of different things.
Right. My tendency is to go onto a car lot of any type. And when I start talking about cars, the salesmen generally start backing away slowly.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I tell you, but on my bucket list is I want to go to Meckham or Barrett Jackson and just bid on a car. That is like, that is my dream, watching those shows and just, and guessing what the price is going to be and if it's an original or have they really, you know, done something to it. I just would love to hold a paddle at one of those two. And
that's too funny.
Well, there's a question for me. I've always said Meckham.
Is it Meckham? I thought it was.
I don't know. That's why I'm saying, I've never heard somebody say it different. So
it's Mark and not Marquis. I know that.
So we're not going to ask Mickey then. Ben, Meckham?
So I'm not really sure. I don't really care because those auctions really disgust me.
They bother you. Bill,
say again. Why do they bother you?
Well, I think, first of all, a lot of people who offer vehicles and those things are trying to turn a quick profit. They're not car people. And they advertise things like, you know, the original air is still in the tires and date coated fan belts and stuff like that. And it's not wholesome. It's not the way cars are supposed to change hands. The ones that I've acquired have all come from either relationships I have in car clubs. The Thunderbird came from the parents of a friend who were retiring, and he had bought it for his father had bought it for his mother as a wedding present. I guess you can't always do that, but I just don't like watching those things because they also drive up the price of what people think that any old car is worth.
Yeah, they become such a
They're a beauty contest. Just say it. It's a beauty contest. It's okay.
Well, they've turned it into such a rich man's game, too.
That's the thing. It's turned it into something that to be affordable. Then you go look in the local car shopper paper, and people think that their cars are worth that, and it's kind of silly. But
well, you know, in Don's defense, kind of, it is television, right? Television is not reality, and television has to be decidedly sensationalistic, especially for an American audience, because sensationalism sells. You know, that emotional hook is what gets people to watch, and that's what makes an advertising dollar worth something.
That's why people watch the Property Brothers restore a destroyed house in half an hour.
Right. Yes, another topic for another day. and possibly another different podcast, but TV, and I mean, as much as I want to, you know, get into the TV game with the thing about cars, the fact of the matter is that television as a general construct doesn't deliver a show to an audience as much as it delivers an audience to an advertiser. And I think that's the problem that you guys might be getting at. Even if I want to be sitting next to Dawn while she raises that paddle and bids on a...
Well, and it also is just really, for me, fascinating. I wonder what the lots look like and the sidebars and the stories behind some of these cars. I think that's what I would like to delve into more. Like, why did it come to auction? And you're right, then people are trying to maybe change over and just get a really good price for it. But some of these cars are, they're just gorgeous. And yeah. I wonder where they've been sitting to be that gorgeous for, you know, and some of them are really old. I yeah. remember seeing a 1932 Ford with a rumble seat, and it was in mint condition. And I just kept wanting to find out, was it completely restored? Did somebody have it in a museum or in a garage? Who knows? I think there's just more depth there than TV land allows to really get into.
Right.
I'll say to me, it's more like porn. I mean, it's really, really nice to look at. Doesn't mean I want to jump in and be a part of it, but there's some pretty eye candy.
Car porn. I never thought about it that way.
Oh, no. I used to get yelled at my first website. I had a link on it that said porn, and it took you to footage that I had shot from like the racetrack or what have you. Oh, my God, you can't label that porn. And then I've seen other people do it since, but... Each have their own.
Right. All right. So we have a bunch of listener questions that we could get into, I think. Some simple ones, like my friend Rody says, simply, are you pro-driving or pro-autonomous driving vehicles? Which I thought was a nice, short, and interesting question. So I don't know how to answer the question. As much as I think it's an interesting question, I don't know how I would personally answer the question. But
I know how I would.
I know how Becca would, too, I'm sure. But pro-driving or pro-autonomous.
But hey, listen, if you're going down I-16 from Macon to Savannah, and you could put my beautiful driving car onto some autonomous thing so I can read a book for that boring drive, I'm all for it. I mean, I don't know if that's a car hauler down the middle of I-16 or what have you, but that is such a boring drive.
Ugh. Well, even within the city, though, I think for pure city urban driving, I think that pro-autonomous may not be that bad. That, you know, if you don't have to keep an eye out for red lights and other cars, maybe having it all become automated would be okay.
Isn't that what the bus is for?
Yeah, but then but then you wouldn't have to get on the bus. You'd have your own car behaving like your own personal bus.
Well, and then there's always the thing that I don't want to have an autonomous, but I would like people that don't know how to drive to have an autonomous car.
Right.
On the other hand, as much as I think that, you know, having autonomous culture would be kind of cool, I would very much hate to give up the option of just being able to hop in my car and put my foot in the engine and go somewhere very fast.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, see, to me, driving is therapy.
Yeah.
You know, it is the excitement that, you know, I love driving.
Yeah.
So it just, yeah, the idea of something else driving for me, no.
Well, Bill, what do you think? Pro-driving or pro-autonomous?
Well, I'm noticing that a great number of young people don't want to learn to drive. And I see it in my own neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a car culture the way there used to be. And frankly, if those people don't want to learn to drive, then maybe they should have self-driving vehicles. I mean, things tend to go in shades and phases. Nobody yeah. knows how to drive a standard transmission car anymore.
I do.
I do too. And so do my sons. But very few people do. And I don't know. I mean, maybe it's the way things are going. I personally don't like it, but I would be categorized by myself and others as an old guy.
Right.
Well, and we've touched on this. It's been quite some time, but the direction of the car culture and what does this mean for the future of the cars as we know it? We've kind of touched on that and have been concerned, you know, will there still be a car passion, you know?
One of the things that I would say, having the old cars that I do, which are in very nice condition and they're, you know, they make people smile. Mm-hmm. I would say that one of the things that I notice is there's two groups of people who wave, smile, and point. The very old and babies. And seriously, and when you look at people who are in their teens, 20s, 30s, it doesn't even turn ahead. I'm not saying everybody, but just in general, it's not It's not like I remember.
Right.
Jessica, as a person who might describe herself as a non-car person, what do you think? Pro driving or pro autonomous driving?
I really like the science behind autonomous driving, but it has to be a universal thing, and there would have to be basically an overhaul for the entire like legislation of driving where everyone had an autonomous car. It'd be a big change, but autonomous driving depends on other autonomous cars. So currently I'm pro people because it's the human error aspect that causes the autonomous cars to have issues in the first place.
That is true. I think that's right. The human error part, the other human drivers, but they're getting better at it. You know, the AI that's behind autonomous driving is getting better at contending with surprises.
Yeah, it's really fascinating.
And you'll take away my ability to drive out of my cold, dead fingers, you know.
Well, let's move on to our next question. My friend Squeak, who is also, we won't give her real name because she goes by Squeak. She asks, and this is a very specific question, why is Toyota not planning on releasing a firmware update to give their older Camrys access to Android Auto? And so she says, when she says older, she means the 2018 Camry, even though the 2020 version is almost the exact same car, including the exact same radio. So why are they releasing a 2020 version with Android Auto, but not releasing an update for the older cars to have Android Auto?
I'm so glad I don't have to use the word firmware with my cars. I just...
I think that's a shame on them.
Having had a career as a product developer in industry, I can tell you that it's expensive to retrofit things to older technology. And then you get pressure from the boardroom that they want to do anything they can to get people to trade up and buy a new one.
Yes.
But why would firmware be more expensive? I mean,
You don't know that it's exactly the same. I mean, it's a quick assumption that it's the same thing, and I'll bet you it's not. It's probably the radio is sourced by somebody else, some other company. There's got to be technical reasons why it's not just a slam dunk. If it was, they'd probably do it. But if there's 1 cent that has to be paid for development on an old product where they really would like you to buy a new one, they're not going to do it. I drove Infinities for years, and as high tech as they were wonderful cars. They had the worst interface to the sound systems that was possible. And they just didn't care about that. So it comes down to on an issue of priorities. Where does that fit in the, in the DNA of that car company?
Right. Well, I'm glad to hear it from somebody who's been involved in the industry that there is a conscious push from within the boardroom to usher people towards buying the new thing.
And I believe that totally reminded me of something. I was going to run over to a website and confirm it. I think the Bronco actually comes with Bang & Olufsen in it. Speaking of stock sound systems that sound awesome.
and just for the record, I'll pull a Ben here and say it's Bong & Olufsen and not Bang.
Hey, I'm from the South. I'm going to say it anyway. I want to say it. It's Bang.
And I support that.
Yeah, we have Ponce de Leon and
Well, I don't know if this will take us too far afield, but this question does actually kind of bring up the thing BMW is doing now or about to do, where they're going to be selling cars that are equipped with the hardware for all their options, but many of these options will only be accessible if you pay a subscription fee for them.
Right.
Oh my God.
Which doesn't seem fair to me at all.
I think that Mercedes did that a while back when they first came out with the SOS, so you could, you know, get somebody if you were stranded, and you know, they gave it to you for free 3 months, and then you had to pay for it.
Now, this is going to apply to, you know, more mundane things like that, like heated seats, for instance. You won't be able to use if you don't pay a subscription.
Oh, now that's going too far.
I love my old cars. I'm staying right there.
Wow. Yeah, he's surprised at how often that happens without having been publicized. It's cheaper to make everything the same, but they haven't had the technology, as you're talking about, to do this enable remotely or subscription basis.
Right.
I think people will react poorly to it. I worked for years for one of the biggest computer companies, and IBM, and that was really common. You know, the systems all had many more features installed in them than people actually accessed. So that actually turning something on was a matter of throwing a software switch than it was actually sending out a serviceman to install something.
Oh, yeah.
No kidding. Wow.
See, I'm cringing over here. It's like the second day that I owned the GM, I went over to my friend and said, okay, how are we going to get this OnStar module out of here? Because I don't like knowing that there is remote access for anybody or anything or no, I don't like Big Brother.
Well, how about the ads from the insurance company with the where they're monitoring your driving using the sensors
and
in the car.
More.
And safe drivers save more money. I mean, what that's about is they want to make sure that you're not going around corners at 3 G's and accelerating from a standstill like you're at the drag strip. Mm-hmm. And by collecting the data from all these sensors, they can do that. In my Mustang, I have a aftermarket auto meter gauge cluster that has more technology in the speedometer head. It's GPS, and I can measure yaw rates and acceleration and all kinds of things by pushing a button. It's nothing to attach that to some sort of module that exports all that. And I will guarantee you, if it's in my gauge cluster, it's in all these new cars that are being made.
Yeah,
and insurance companies are always looking for ways to determine who's safe and who's not. And for years, they've done it by who has more education.
Yes, that's right.
It's more than that, but I don't know how far back you've listened. I had 14 years in insurance. It's more than that. It is any slight little thing to say, oh, you're not. They don't want to be able to classify people as safe drivers because safe drivers don't pay as much.
Sure.
So there's more, and I understand.
They're using credit ratings of all things. Credit rating is allegedly an indicator on how safe you're going to be with your driving.
We've been using credit ratings for your car insurance for decades, honey.
Oh, yeah.
It's long.
I'm not saying it's new. I'm just saying they do it.
And so is social media now.
Yeah.
Social media.
Yes.
People are looking at algorithms and where you are on a social media scale to look at your insurability for health, for car, for house, everything.
We don't even need algorithms. We go out there just to see what you do.
Okay, so Jessica needs to be aware of this because she likes to turn her car into an off-road vehicle every time she gets a chance. I'm just kidding, Jessica. I'm not being serious.
Okay, I was about to go, wait, the Yaris?
No.
Off-road?
The airborne.
I was laughing, but I'm on mute, so I don't make weird noise.
All right, so next listener question is from our friend Eric. Eric asks, what's the best car for a teen? He scored a really, really good car for his son who's just learning how to drive. He said they found a super low mileage 2008 Mazda 3 hatchback. It's a hoot to drive, and he says it has a great interior. But the general question is, what do we think is the best car for a teen, a new driver?
See, I've been asked this actually standing on car lots before and, you know, thought the teenager was just going to kill me. But I suggest something that appears to be at least sort of reliable, but a teenage driver is going to hit things. They're going to damage that car. So something that you aren't going to be too upset about being damaged, or at least easy to fix. I guess it depends. Maybe you're totally fine with fixing things, but nothing shiny and new. And
so name a brand name car, Becca. What would you, if you had to pick make and model of a car, what would you pick?
Everybody has a different idea of what is safe and reliable.
Right. So what's yours?
Quit it.
2003 Hyundai XL.
Yeah, there you go.
Sure.
Actually, the idea that I would love to do for my boys, because remember, I have times two. When my boys become old enough to drive, they are twins. Everything is times two. But my idea had always been a VW Bug.
Oh, interesting.
But
VW Bugs.
But the price, they've become the in thing, I guess. And the price of even one that needs serious rebuilding is crazy. It's insane to pay that much for something that needs, you know, that much work. But they're easy to maintain. You know, at one time it was easier to get parts, easier to fix. if they get dents and scrapes and what have you, it happens. You know, it's not going to be brand new and shiny. And I can't believe you put a scratch on that car, you know.
Right. If you're talking about old air-cooled Beetles, you know, they've become so, you know, old now that it's kind of, you know, specialized tribal knowledge to maintain
them. I agree with you.
Yeah,
it used to be.
That went through for a generation back. But the 2003 Hyundai XL is the new version.
Right.
It used to be $200 to rebuild the engine. Way back.
What were you about to say, Don?
I was going to say the bigger the car, the better, because I think that if a teenager starts on a really big vehicle, it's easier for them to get a sense of their spatial turning and all of that, and then they can downsize from there. My first car that I learned to drive on was a Chevy van. It was huge. In Germany, my driver's test, I had to parallel park between a Porsche and a BMW.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So I think the bigger the car, the better, just to give the teenager the chance to have that spatial. And then it's easier to drive a smaller car. It's not always easier.
The downside is, though, that the bigger it is, the more damage their mistakes are going to cause to others.
Exactly. Well, that's what I was thinking.
So that's the question. Do you have a bubble around them or a bubble, around, you know?
That's an interesting toss-up, spaceman. But Ben, what car would you pick if you had to pick one? What make and model would you choose for a teenager?
Yeah, I really can't go with any one. Just something that's, you know, like that Hyundai or like the Mazda, you know, something that's cheap and mass-produced and, you know, isn't going to be a lemon.
Yeah, and I was thinking along the same terms. I mean, I was thinking, you know, a 5 to 7 year old Civic or a Camry or something like that.
Yeah,
you know, cheap, plenty of parts. No one's going to cry if it goes boom.
And if you got the kind of teenager who's got, you know, a really strong individualistic streak, it's still a blank canvas. They can have, you know, fun making it their own, no matter what it is.
True. Don, would you care to weigh in on that? What they make and model?
Sure. I mean, I think that you're right. If you're going to talk mass produced, those Hyundais are, you know, everywhere, and they've got lots of exchangeable parts. There's a small SUV called a Tucson.
Yeah.
I think you can get an older Tucson. I think for American made, you could do a Chevy Traverse, or although they're not going to make them anymore, the Dodge Journey, if you want to get a bigger car. And then unfortunately those Toyota Priuses and the Camrys,
right?
It is what it is. I mean, they're easy to take care of.
Yeah. There's nothing unfortunate about that.
Yeah. So that's where I would put it. I think there's a lot of choices.
Next listener question. And I think we're running up on the end of the show here, but we'll do one more listener question, which is from our old friend Leanne, who's been on the show a couple times.
Yeah.
And may it return. She says she saw our request for questions. She says, you may want to discuss what to do for cars that have actually been sitting too long in garages due to the pandemic. Because we touched on this briefly in terms of, you know, how do you keep your car from needing extra work from sitting too long? So take it out, let the battery recharge, get your brakes moving, things like that. But for cars that have already passed that point, what to do for cars that have been sitting too long, you know, how then do you get a car that's been sitting too long back into running order?
Well, it depends on how old the car is, how long it's been sitting.
I thought I heard Bill chuckle. Bill, you want to explain?
I mean, I have, with three old cars in the garage, even if I were able to drive one every other week, it still means that they're not being driven very often. And I think the biggest problem is with the battery, because batteries are meant to be charged and discharged.
Yep.
I know that and there was a lot of problem when people were not driving, that people were needing battery service. So having a trickle charger on your battery is a good investment. I have something that I got it. Well, you can get them anywhere now, but the battery tender from Eastwood, which just kind of keeps the battery topped up, is helpful to have. One of the challenges with some of these newer technology batteries is that if they lose a lot of their charge,
the memory's
very hard to charge them again with a regular charger. You need a special charger to charge them, or they just won't take it.
So
that's a problem. And I've got them now in all of my cars, so I do what I can to prevent them from falling below that point. other than that, there's not a lot to worry about. But
before you move on, I was just going to do a quick, I have trickle chargers from Harbor Freight. I love Eastwood, don't get me wrong. And and maybe in the long run, Eastwood's probably better. But Harbor Freight, I love, and their trickle chargers are a lot cheaper.
And they sure are. Everything from Harbor Freight is cheaper.
Right. Yeah. So I was just going to throw that out there just for an option too, Harbor Freight trickle charger.
Yep. But Bill, you were saying?
No, I was just kind of wrapping up with, in modern cars, there's not much else you have to worry about. I mean, you should still have your oil changed on a regular basis, even if you're not driving the car, because acid gets in the oil, and when it sits for a long time, it can eat away at the bearings, and people don't think about that. They think that the only time that you've got to change your oil is when you've driven lots of miles, but time is an issue as well.
That's why they put on there, and this is the old one, I know, but 3 months or 3,000 miles, because there is a time frame as well.
Right, exactly. So what about brakes? You know, getting your brakes to not rust over and freeze. Once you have rusted brake rotors, what does a person do about that?
Just drive it and use them. It'll take it right off.
In modern cars, you're not going to have a
problem. Yeah. Well, I mean, if I don't drive my Accord for a couple of days, I see a nice little thin film of rust on the rotors. But like Ben said, you just drive it and it goes away.
Yeah, and on modern cars, like everybody's using the word modern, and it's you have to. There's a distinction on even on the Mustang. The rotors aren't so old a technology or something that driving it isn't going to remove anything. It's just a visual, and you guys know here that the Mustang can sit for a year.
Sure.
So that's in the rust that you see might look unsightly, but it's nothing that's really going to impact anything unless you've already machined it down to below spec or something. And as far as fluids and things, it's not a concern unless it's an older car, because the different types of seals, modern seals on modern cars aren't going to start, corroding away, I guess, for lack of better words, and your oil system's going to be compromised. It's going to be fine.
We've talked about batteries and how to maintain them if you don't drive them. We've talked about the brake thing. If you have actual seized rotors, then I think that requires taking the car in anyway, so that might require a tow. But to Becca's point about seals and hoses, I would say that if you have a car that's been sitting for a long time, see if it's leaking anything, right? Look underneath the car and check it. Like, check your fluid levels, check the oil level, check the transmission fluid level. Mm-hmm. And if any of that looks suspect, then you know what you have to do. So.
Mm-hmm. And aside from that, and this really just gets into long-term sitting still, fuel is actually getting better, but a lot of times if you know your car is going to be stored for a long time, you have to add a fuel stabilizer, because fuel can break down. Also, tires, if it's been sitting in one spot, they start to get like a rot in one area if they haven't been moving. But it's getting into long-term sitting still. We're not talking, a couple months. So,
yeah, I think there's a difference between if you're going to store it and you think about it and you're just not going to use it. How do you think? I mean, like, if you're going to really store a car.
Right. And speaking of that, though, something that nobody ever considers, and this will happen to a vehicle, regardless of whether it is outside or in a garage, trust me, you got to worry about the critters.
Oh, yes.
I was going to say that, too. You do. You have to worry about who's gotten in and chewed away at something.
This is morbid as hell, but you mean I can't drive down the interstate and just shoot all those mice out my muffler?
No, because they're not in your muffler.
They're in your and your headliner and your heater box.
Yeah. They're in your trunk. They're in your wires. They poop on your engine. I'm just saying.
God, can't have that. I hate it when things poop on my engine. So speaking of really old cars, Leanne has sort of a second, more specific question, and this may be the last thing we cover today. She says, I need to know how to repair the anti-theft master switch lock on Miss Buttercup, which we may remember is a 1936 Ford Roadster. She says, it has just become difficult. Something changed in the steering column with the transmission switch, so now you have to jiggle the steering wheel and find the right sweet spot for the key to turn. The 36 actually had the anti-theft property where you turn the wheel and it locks. The master key releases that as well. So She doesn't know how to repair that thing, and I don't even know where to begin.
I could take a little bit of a guess. In a lot of cases, the steering column locks are just like a little, you know, tab or a tang that sticks into the little hole in the side of the column to keep it from turning. Maybe the end of that has become a little mushroomed or something. I don't know. Beyond that, you know, it's all wild guesses.
Well, and I think the sad fact of the matter is she's going to have to take it apart to fix it one way or the other.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So that is it. You guys got anything we need to be sure to discuss today?
I sent out a little reminder before we ended before.
Yes.
And it looked like a really weird reminder. It just said car brains.
Car brains.
And I didn't know if that was going to stump you, and you haven't said anything about it. Going, what the heck is car brains?
I admit, when we closed down that chat, I forgot all about it. But car brains. So this has nothing to do with zombie cars eating other car brains.
Actually, we could kind of look at it that way. So I've been having to look at my options, and we've discussed it at various times in the past about what should I do with my G8. And I make a lot of jokes, but the sad truth is I love that poor, stupid car. I have to decide what to do. At this point, repairing it is not really an option right now. So I have in the past contacted my local G8 group that I used to be a lot more involved with. I've even contacted the national group. Everybody always talks about wanting a G8 project car. Then they suddenly don't want one when they hear, oh, you need a DOD delete. But then if you look at the other option of, okay, selling to just open market, I have a G8 that needs repair. A lot of places, Mickey, you had suggested bring a trailer, which the name does not suggest what kind of company it is. You need to be a functional car. You need to be from what it seems like a collectible car, all this in her current condition would not be a viable car for that option. You know, I can always do something like eBay or what have you, but that's, you know, again, you have to worry about, is somebody going to turn this into a parts car? And I'm having nightmares about things happening to this car, which is something.
You're basically saying you want to sell the car, but you want to sell it to a good home.
Right. I want to rehome.
You belong to a car club.
Say I'm again, sorry?
Bill? Do you belong to a car club?
I already talked about the local G8 club. Nobody there has wanted it.
See, that's what I have found is if you're going to find a good home for a specialty car, I mean, 99 out of 100 people would say, what is a G8?
Exactly.
They would have no idea what it is. And the people in your car club, if they're not interested in it, to me, that is... that's a wake-up call, maybe, because you're going to have a hard time in the general population finding somebody who's going to care more than people who are enthusiasts in a club. I know I'm not being terribly...
Well, no. I get exactly what you mean, but I'm also, and I'm not wanting to really talk about this for many reasons. I'm seeing a tendency with the mentality of the people that own G8s currently. I'm not going to be specific, but I think the club is less about love for the car than, say, a Mustang car club or a Studebaker car club. They are not concerned about longevity of said vehicle. You know what I mean?
I'm going to leave it. More of a drive it into the ground group than a preservation group.
They would rather be race car drivers.
Sure.
And
it's cheap wheels.
They're not cheap. These cars are not, when they are in working condition, that's another part of it. This car, they're still going for a lot of money when they work. Anyways, if you
sounds
look
like a Jaguar.
Yep, exactly.
If you look for places that buy, like these, we buy junk cars, just they part them out, they crush them, sure, they scrap metal. And again, I was talking about my nightmares. I didn't have a chance to say that previously had only been something that I had about the Mustang. Now I'm having nightmares about the G8.
So what about, where does brains come into this equation?
Car Brains is a company that gives you a quote on buying cars that are repairable with the intention of putting in whatever they can to fix it and resell it and gain money that way. So I had not heard of this previously, and I was just doing searches and, you know, what are my other options? There has to be a secret option number three. And I had found this Car Brains, and they will do a quick kind of thing. And there's a number of questions, but they'll do a quick website thing, and then they will reach out to you to talk to you more about it. But it's the idea of you sell them a car that is either non-working or works but needs repair, and they'll buy it from you based on that, and then they'll fix it and turn around and sell it for their profit. I found it interesting. I don't know. It might not be a great talking topic, maybe. I don't know. But for other people who are listening that may have a car that they love and can't stand the thought of it being, you know, a carcass for a bunch of vultures or something, right, and just want to find a new option. Right. There's another option I found, and maybe there's even other companies if that doesn't work out for them. But there is secret option number three if you're in a situation like I am.
Right. Well, we're almost out of time. We've run up on an hour for an episode that usually lasts 30 minutes. so we've done a good job today. let's wrap this episode by doing the Grand Trivia Auto thing and answering that question for everybody. The question was, one of the most infamous failures in automotive history, this Ford Mark lasted just three model years from 1958 to 1960 and lost hundreds of millions of dollars. Was that Mark? Thank you, Ben.
Marquis.
You're welcome.
Was that Mark the Edsel, the Nova, the Pinto, or the Corvair?
Really, people?
And Ben. Yeah, Ben, Don, go first.
Edsel.
Edsel. Jessica, what do you think?
Edsel, I'm going to go with that one.
Ben, what do you think?
Oh, it's Edsel for sure.
For sure. Bill?
How could I argue with the truth?
I knew you guys were all going to know this. Becca?
I so want to mess with you.
Well, you have less than 60 seconds to do it.
Oh my God, it's the Edsel.
Right. The Edsel was produced in a variety of sedans and station wagons, none of which were popular, and their failure cost the company around $250 million over 3 years. And I don't know if those are dollars adjusted for time.
So and the Nova and the Corvair are not Fords.
Right.
The Pinto was around in the 60s and I believe 70s.
That's right.
Yeah, we keep threatening that if we have a cat that is just not performing up to speed of our others, it's going to be called a Pinto.
Hey, the Corvair was far worse. The Pinto has gotten a bad rap. They didn't give it an appropriate fuel cage. I'm just saying.
So to our listeners, Pinto, Thank you again for joining us. If you have an opinion about Edsels or Pintos, please drop us a line at our website, thethingaboutcars.com, or join us on Facebook. You can find the Thing About Cars Facebook page, and sometimes there's a good conversation happening there. Whatever you are doing, whatever you're driving, wherever you are, please be safe. Tell us what's on your mind, and we look forward to seeing you with another episode in about a week. Take care. Be careful.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye, all.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.